So today we're going to talk about church and state. We want to look at Constantine, look at his conversion and some of the consequences that flowed immediately from that. Then we're going to look at how the relationship between church and state developed after Constantine. We're going to look at some differences again between the East and the West. All through this class you've seen the two halves of the empire branching off, heading in different directions, thinking slightly differently on subjects. We'll certainly see that when it comes to the relationship between church and state. And then we'll think a little bit about some of the gains and losses that came when the state became, first of all, tolerant of Christianity, then embraced it, and then mandated it. So we'll begin with Constantine. The setting here is, and we're talking now the late 200s, the early 300s. The empire is unwieldy. It's hard to communicate. It's hard to exercise administration across such a large geographic area. And so the empire had been divided. There was an eastern part and a western part. Each part was ruled by an Augustus, sort of a top-level emperor. And then each Augustus had a junior called a Caesar. So there were four rulers split across the two sides. And the Augusti were often at war with each other or with other usurpers. And this is the environment in which Constantine becomes a Christian. By the end of the third century, Christianity had become a force to reckon with in the Roman Empire. Numbers are very hard to come by. But one author, this is Rodney Stark, a sociologist I've mentioned a number of times before, estimates that by the year 300 or so, that Christians made up about 10 to 11% of the population of the Roman Empire. In other words, they were a significant number, and that the government had to deal with that. They had to reckon with the fact that a very large number, relatively speaking, of their citizens were, in fact, Christians. So we come to Constantine's conversion. It was a much more gradual affair than we sometimes think. We hear about the famous sign before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and imagine something like Paul's sudden conversion on the road to Damascus. And it wasn't that way. Constantine didn't do that kind of about-face that the apostle to the Gentiles did. Constantine's father, who was also named Constantine, it gets really messy here, by the way. His father was Constantine, he was Constantine, he had sons, which are Constantine and Constantius, and they were really very, very impoverished, imagination-wise, when it came to sons. So they're all named some form of Constans, Constantine, Constantius, and so on. And so I'm going to try to talk about as few of them as possible. But his father was a military officer who rose to be Caesar of the West in 293, and he became the Augustus, again, the top-level emperor of the West in 303. He campaigned in Germany and Britain. He viewed Christians as good and loyal citizens and protected them in the West during Diocletian's persecution. Remember, Diocletian was the emperor of the East, and he initiated the last, what's in fact it's called the Great Persecution, the last fierce imperial empire-wide persecution that lasted from 303 to 311. But during that time, as I said, Constantine's father protected Christians in the West. He may or may not have been married to Helena, and Helena may or may not have been a Christian before her son's conversion. The data is kind of unsure. As I say, Constantine may have been married to Helena. She may have been his common-law wife. And as I said, there is some evidence that she might have been a Christian, but on the other hand, other evidence that she only became a Christian after her son. If she was a Christian, that means that Constantine was raised in a quasi-Christian household. It appears that he didn't actually spend a lot of time with his father. His father was off campaigning a lot. Constantine had some Christian influence of some sort, and he certainly had the example of his father, who was at least tolerant and protective of Christians. Constantine later told the bishop and church historian Eusebius, "My father revered the Christian God and uniformly prospered, while the emperors who worshipped the heathen gods died a miserable death. Therefore, that I may enjoy a happy life and reign, I will imitate the example of my father and join myself to the cause of the Christians, who are growing daily, while the heathen are diminishing." There's a lot in that quote. You see, it's not really a quote in which Constantine is impressed by the truth of Christianity, by the need to be in relationship with one true God. Rather, he sees that it works. You profess this religion and you win battles. Furthermore, he said, in the third century dialect, "I want to be on the right side of history." He thought that the Christians were growing, the pagans were losing. He wanted to be on the winning side. And that's interesting. He says all this to Eusebius. Eusebius was the famous church historian. He's called the father of church history. His history is really the first church history we have. And Eusebius was a sycophant. He worshipped Constantine. He wrote a life of Constantine that is just almost embarrassing in how much he flatters him. Eusebius was just struck by the incredible reversal that happened in Eusebius' lifetime, going from the great persecution of Diocletian to the moment when the emperor now becomes a Christian, favors Christianity, calls together the first ecumenical council, and perhaps drunk with this change of affairs, wasn't as critical as he could have been of Constantine. So Constantine became ruler of the West on the death of his father, which happened in 306, and he fought a series of civil wars against Maxentius and Licinius, Maxentius in the West and Licinius in the East, for sole control of the empire, which he only achieved in the year 324, a year that should stick in your mind. That's the year before the Council of Nicaea. It was only when he had achieved complete control of the empire that he was able to deeply involve himself in the affairs of the church and call that council. So he fought this series of civil wars. Early on in his battle against Maxentius, he fought the famous Battle of the Milvian Bridge in October 312. And this is the moment that lives in legend. There are a number of stories about this. The church historian Lactantius, who wrote just 3 years after this, tells one story. Constantine told Eusebius many years later a different story, which Eusebius only published after the death of Constantine. So the details are kind of murky. According to Lactantius, Constantine had a dream at night in which he was told, by whom we don't know, to emblazon the cross on the shields of his soldiers. Eusebius, claiming to report Constantine's own description of this, says the emperor told him he saw a daylight vision of the cross with the inscription "by this conquer," and then received the next day, or the next evening, an appearance of Christ in the night, who directed him to prepare a standard in the form of the cross. No one really knows exactly what happened, but clearly Constantine believed that he had been given a sign of some sort, in words or actually in a vision, by God, that God was on his side. He won the battle, which of course encouraged his conviction that God had intervened. And that was the moment that Constantine started publicly to align himself with Christianity. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. One of the first fruits of his alignment is the famous Edict of Milan. But in my notes, I say the Edicts of Toleration. And I say edicts because Constantine's Edict of Toleration in 313 is actually not the first. It turns out that Galerius, who was one of the rulers of the East, who did not like Christianity one little bit, in fact, he had been the one who urged Diocletian, back when Galerius was like the number two guy, and Diocletian was the number one guy in the East, he was the one who urged Diocletian to persecute the faith in 303. But then as Galerius was dying, he had second thoughts, as men do on their deathbed sometimes, and in 311 he issued an edict called the Edict of Certica, which ended the persecution and granted a certain amount of toleration to Christianity. No one ever remembers that. In fact, I'm not sure I'd ever even heard of the Edict of Certica until recently. It doesn't get the play because Constantine, well, The church wrote Constantine's story. They didn't write Galerius' story. Sertica, by the way, is a city, which is now the city of Sofia in Bulgaria. So the persecution had been ended actually earlier, and by a man who didn't particularly care for Christianity. But then, as I said, in 313, Constantine, who now is the ruler of the West, and Licinius, who was the ruler of the East, they issued the famous Edict of Milan, granting religious liberty to Christians who were mentioned by that name, and indeed to all religions, but the Christians were singled out, and then also required that the property seized by imperial agents, property seized from Christians, be restored. So that was a step further than what Galerius had done. As I said, Constantine's conversion was more gradual, and it seems never to have led to any particularly deep moral transformation. This is what gives people ammunition for saying he never was converted. Basically, you tell me whether you think Constantine was a Christian, and I can tell you what denomination you belong to, pretty much. If you're a Baptist, you think he wasn't converted. If you think he was converted, then you're everything else. It does seem to me that whether you think the conversion of the empire to Christianity was a good thing really determines whether you think, in fact, Constantine himself was converted. So some of the evidence that goes both ways. I'll give you some of that. He did immediately attribute his military success to the protection of the Christian God. He granted toleration to Christians and, indeed, to other religions. He commanded restitution to Christians of their property that had been stolen. He paid for the construction of many churches and protection of a number of expensive Bibles. Eusebius records that Constantine ordered and paid for the production of 50 elaborately decorated Bibles, of which Codex Sinaiticus, which is probably our oldest complete Bible manuscript, might be one. We're not entirely sure. It's an incredible production. It's written on vellum, includes the whole Bible, plus a couple of New Testament apocryphal books, Shepherd of Hermas, the Epistle of Barnabas, and so on. It's a very famous manuscript. I'm digressing here. This is the manuscript that Constantine Tischendorf found in the monastery of St. Catherine in the Sinai, in the shadow, literally the shadow of Mount Sinai. There are some pictures that you should go on the internet and look for a picture of the monastery of St. Catherine. It's a beautiful, starkly beautiful thing. You see the mountain almost vertical, and then right next to it you see the monastery, which was originally built in the 500s, and it's still a functioning monastery. It has been since those days, run by Eastern Orthodox monks. Constantine Tischendorf was a German who traveled to Sinai. He got the authority and some money from the Tsar of Russia, figuring that the Eastern Orthodox monks would be more receptive to him if he came in the name of the Russian Tsar. And he discovered, in a somewhat controversial way, this manuscript. He took 43 leaves of it back to Germany and then took another trip and got most of the rest of the manuscript. Published it in the mid-1800s. As I said, it's the oldest manuscript, full manuscript of the Bible we have. It wound up, because it was given to the Tsar, it wound up in the hands of the Soviets. And the Soviets, in the 20s, I think it was, were short of cash. Apparently, even when you're a communist, you still need money. And so they sold this Bible, which they had no real interest in. It was the opiate of the masses. But they sold it to the British Museum for £100,000, which today wouldn't even buy you a Rolls Royce. But in those days, it was a fair amount of money. There was a massive campaign appealing to the British people to contribute their pence and their shillings to the fund. They raised the money, and the British Museum, actually it was 1933 now that I think about it, they bought this codex, and it now lives in the British Museum. Well, at any rate, so we really hope that's one of the manuscripts that Constantine paid for, but scholars aren't quite sure. He Constantine did a number of other things. We'll talk about this in some more detail later, but he, for instance, forbade gladiatorial shows in his new capital city of Constantine. They were pretty well entrenched in Rome. He couldn't quite get rid of those so easily. He removed pagan symbols from the imperial coinage. He did a lot of things, and I'll say a few more things later, that indicate a desire to make the policies of the Roman state align with Christianity. On the other hand, he continued to use the pagan religious title of Pontifex Maximus. Pontifex means bridge. The chief priest of the Roman religion was the bridge to the pagan gods. So he continued to use that pagan title, a title which, by the way, is now borne by the Pope. He murdered his son and his wife. He executed his former co-emperor, Licinius, breaking a promise of mercy that he had extended. And he also delayed his baptism until he was near death, which was not terribly uncommon in those days. As I've said, he seemed to have a rather utilitarian view of Christianity, at least at times. We've already saw how he drew a lesson from the military victories that his father won. And so he often seemed to see Christianity, no matter what its merits as a way to heaven might be, as a tool to use the empire. When we talked about the Trinitarian controversies, we saw that he viewed the disunion within the church over the question of the full deity of Christ as endangering the unity of his empire. And so he interjected himself in the church's doctrinal struggles, usually in an unhelpful way. He wasn't really all that theologically astute. And we saw how he called the Council of Nicaea, the first council, in 325, in an attempt to try to settle the Arian controversy. We also saw that although the council got the right answer, it didn't completely solve things. It took the better part of a century for the church to think through the data and finally decide what the right answer was. And it didn't really help anybody that the emperor had come down on one side. If anything, I think it may have made some people say, well, we don't care what he has to say. We want to think this through for ourselves. And you probably, I hope you remember, that I pointed out that is counter evidence against the claim of people like Dan Brown that the Roman Empire imposed Christianity, Orthodox Catholic Christianity, on the church. It really was not like that at all. Constantine, in approving of Christianity, in giving certain privileges, made it advantageous to be a Christian, with the result that many poorly evangelized folk flooded into the church, lowering the standard of Christian living and bringing a great deal of worldliness. Well, Constantine fell sick, was baptized by, ironically, a semi-Arian bishop. He was the guy who was nearby, and died some miles from Constantinople in 337. The empire had not been declared officially Christian. He simply tolerated Christianity. He gave certain privileges, but he did not say it was that Christianity was the religion of the empire, much less did he outlaw paganism. That will come later. So, after the death of Constantine, his three sons divided up the empire, all named some variation of Constant or Constantine or Constantius. They seemed to have been more influenced by his deeds and by his faith. They fought amongst themselves. We'll skip over them. Some guys happen. And then we come to Julian the Apostate. This is significant. Julian the Apostate was his nephew. He had been given a Christian education, but he wasn't terribly impressed by the Christians he saw, neither his uncle nor his cousins. There wasn't a lot of Christian living going on in the imperial household. He secretly practiced paganism, and when he came to the throne in 361, he threw off the mask, announced that he was indeed a pagan and that he intended to restore paganism. He was attempting to reverse the course of history. He was a clever man, and he recognized that persecution actually tended to purify and strengthen the Christian church. So he said, I'm not going to persecute Christianity. In fact, I'm going to grant more tolerance than even before. And in tolerating everything, he particularly encouraged the heretical sects, was happy to see the discord within Christianity that resulted from that. And he, I mentioned, he adopted the garb and the non-existent personal hygiene habits of a philosopher. The description that I've read of him, hair growing long, his fingernails growing long, reminds me of nothing more than the story of Howard Hughes in his last days. And if you're as old as I am, you remember what a sad end that person came to. Well, in an attempt, again, to discredit Christianity, to make Jesus a false prophet, he encouraged the Jews to return to Jerusalem. Remember that after the Bar Kokhba revolt, ending in about 135, Jews had been banished from Jerusalem. The city had been razed, and then it had been rebuilt under a different name. So Julian encouraged the Jews to return, and he committed the vast resources of the empire to rebuilding the temple, figuring that if he can rebuild the temple, then Jesus' prophecy that not one stone will be left, it will never be rebuilt, will be discredited, and everybody will know Jesus was a false prophet. But like many other government projects before and since, the work failed, and the temple was never built. A friend of his, a pagan Roman historian, Ammianus Marcellinus, wrote, "Julian thought to rebuild at an extravagant expense the proud temple once at Jerusalem and committed this task to Alypius of Antioch. Alypius set vigorously to work and was seconded by the governor of the province. When fearful balls of fire breaking out near the foundations continued their attacks till the workmen, after repeated scorchings, could approach no more, and he gave up the attempt." Even the pagans, at least this one, seemed to see God's hand in frustrating Julian's attempt to rebuild the temple, and were impressed by that. Well, Julian only lived for reigned for 18 months. He died, and he was the last pagan guy. He was the last gasp, the last emperor to profess paganism. Then we'll just hit a couple of key moments later. Under Valentinian I, who died in 375, so about 12 years after Julian, the old Roman religion was first officially called paganism, which meant something like peasant religion. You remember I told you earlier on that paganos, the Roman word, means rural, the outlying districts. And by this time, the cities were the stronghold of Christianity. Most of the believers in the old religion lived out in the countryside, where they were conservative in the sense that they didn't change. And so in those days, it was considered the rural farm dwellers who resisted Christianity. And so paganism became the name. Yes?
So previously, there had been an east and a west. Constantine was west, but he's in Constantinople, which is towards the east. Was there a flip-flop? Did his lineage eventually become emperor of the east, or was there a reunification?
Right. Right, so the question is, how does Constantine fit into the division of East and West? And I skated over a little bit of that. He became emperor of the West after he defeated Maxentius in 312 at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. He went on fighting for another dozen years against Licinius, the Eastern emperor, finally put him down in 324. So he then became the sole emperor of a united Roman Empire. Then after his death, again, his son sort of split the empire. The empire will sort of come together, fall apart, come together a number of times over the next some years. And actually, I'll talk about in a minute about the last guy who ruled over both. So when Constantine took control of the whole empire, he decided to found a new city. The emperors had more and more found it important to be in the east. There was more going on. They were fighting Parthians in particular. Parthia was really the other great power. They certainly had all along the Danube, they were fighting various Germanic tribes that were infiltrating. But the great organized opponent of the Roman Empire was the Parthians. And so many emperors felt it was important to be based in the east. So, again, Constantine set up this, took the city of Byzantium, refurbished it, renamed it Constantinople, and made it the new headquarters of the Roman Empire. All right, then we move on to Theodosius I. Theodosius, sometimes called the Great. He reigned from 379 to 395. He was a particularly consequential fellow in a number of ways. He was the last emperor to rule over both the East and the West. After him, the empire was split permanently, and never again was one man in charge of both East and West at the same time. A year after his accession to the throne, he made Christianity the official religion of the empire. Again, Constantine tolerated Christianity, gave it certain privileges, but he did not make it the official religion of the empire. That was left to Theodosius. He issued a proclamation that reads in part like this. We will that all our subjects steadfastly adhere to the religion which was taught by St. Peter to the Romans and which is now professed by Damasus of Rome and Peter, Bishop of Alexandria, a man of apostolic holiness. It's interesting right away. When he talks about the two current leaders, he picks the Pope of Rome and the Patriarch, a Bishop of Alexandria. And this day he's looking at Alexandria as the top city in the East. According to the institution of the apostles and the doctrine of the gospel, let us believe in the one Godhead of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, of equal majesty in the Holy Trinity. So there he's saying, we're going to believe in Nicene Christianity, not Arian Christianity. We order that the adherents of this faith be called Catholic Christians, universal Christians. We brand all the senseless followers of other religions with the infamous name of heretics and forbid their conventicles assuming the name of churches. He actually doesn't forbid them to meet, but he says you can't call yourself a church. Only the Catholic or universal Christians, the Trinitarian Christians, can be called, can have churches. Besides the condemnation of divine justice, they must expect the heavy penalties which our authority, guided by heavenly wisdom, shall think proper to inflict. So he's saying, not only if you're wrong, will you God judge you later, I'll judge you now. Turns out he didn't do a whole lot of that, but still he said, as you read in all the restaurants, the management reserves the right to punish non-Christians or deviant Christians. Then, a little bit later, he did make it illegal to perform pagan worship in a temple, and the next year made it illegal to perform pagan worship at home. He did not order the destruction of pagan temples, but the population could see which way the wind was blowing, and we start to hear during his reign of mobs burning down pagan temples. Some of the church, no doubt, rejoiced at this, a little bit of, now you get a taste of your own medicine. But fortunately, there were some in the church who protested this. And here is John Chrysostom, bishop in the capital city, saying, Christians are not to destroy error by force and violence, but should work the salvation of men by persuasion, instruction, and love. John was, in some ways, a voice crying in the wilderness. Of course, one of the great themes of the embrace of Christianity by the state is that the church was very often perfectly happy to use the state to enforce its will. They were perfectly happy to drop the tools that Christ had given them and use the tools of the world to gain their power. Well, so we've moved from a time when Christianity was outlawed and fiercely persecuted during Diocletian to now Theodosius declaring Christianity the official, the only legal religion, in fact, not just Christianity, but the Nicene form, branding all other Arian, sub-Trinitarian views as non-Christian and under proscription. Doug?
Maybe a very elementary question, but how did Theodosius become the great, and how do those titles throughout history, how do they come into being, and who makes them great?
Historians. And so the question is, how do historians do that? Well, the answer is, if enough historians call him great and enough people go along with it, that's how it happens. All right, enough people say it, then it becomes true, apparently, or at least people are used to using that term. I want to talk now a little bit about the differences between the East and the West on church and state. As you've heard me say, all through the history of the early church, you start to see differences in the Greek and Roman mindset. You see differences in circumstances leading to thinking about things in different ways. We saw, for instance, that the Greeks were particularly interested in and well-versed in technical philosophy. Westerners Less so, the Westerners, if you can make generalizations. Westerners were a little more hard-headed. They were the engineers. The East were philosophers. The Romans were engineers. They built an aqueduct. The Greeks might wonder what water is, and the Romans figured, let's just figure out how to get you some water. These are generalizations, and like every generalization, it has its weaknesses. But, you know, these, I think stereotypes exist because there's a lot of truth into them often. And so we come to the church and state, and we'll see the same sort of thing going on there. The differences can be overstated, but there is, in fact, a noticeable difference in how Easterners and Westerners thought about the relationship between church and state. In the Eastern half, the church came to be seen as a department of the state. The emperor was above the state. The emperor was above the church, and the church answered to the government. Some of the factors, I think, that led to this, right away, Constantine, although he was not even a baptized Christian until a few days before he died, called himself the Bishop of Bishops. He viewed himself as both the protector of the church, but also, in some ways, its governor. He, of course, called into being the Council of Nicaea. He felt it was his prerogative to do so. And he even tried to intervene a bit here and there, although he also had tremendous respect for the bishops. But the bishops had a lot of respect for him. No one told him to butt out. You don't do that to the emperor. Another factor, I believe, that played into this is that the Eastern Empire had long had, in fact, the East, just the Greek East, had long had a tradition of deference and indeed worship of the emperor. It was in the East that the tradition arose that after a Roman emperor died, he was to be considered deified. In the East, they would worship the emperor as a god. And as soon as he died, they would declare that he had been seen ascending to heaven. And so it would be, if you read, for instance, Suetonius, his famous book, The 12 Caesars. It's kind of like the People magazine of the Roman Empire, in which he described the usually scandalous lives of the 12, and Suetonius made sure if there was a scandalous detail, he included it, and perhaps invented a few. But the titles, you'll notice, is things like Julius Caesar, afterward deified. And over, you see, afterward deified. That didn't catch on in the West immediately. For a while, hard-headed Romans thought that was silly. I knew Julius. In fact, I helped kill him. How can he be a god? But eventually, you know, when the emperor just makes it known that he'd like to be considered a god, it's healthful to call him a god. But this started in the East. So there was this tradition of deference to the state and to the emperor. I think that probably contributed to the subservience of the church. Another factor is that church power in the East was divided among four major sees, four major bishoprics, all of which were at least thought to have some apostolic connection. You had Jerusalem, where it all began. You had Alexandria and Antioch. Antioch, of course, was the see of Peter. Paul's missionary journeys began there. Alexandria was in this very rich province of Egypt. Alexandria was the great center of learning in those days. And then Constantinople, which actually had none of that, but it was where the emperor lived. And so it was very quickly learned that, in fact, an apostle had come to Byzantium. No one knew that until it had been made the capital city, but all of a sudden they discovered that. So now we had four major sees, all of which with at least supposed apostolic authority, apostolic pedigree. And because you had four of them, they in a sense canceled each other out. They jockeyed for position. There was no one bishopric in the East that stood above all the others. And, you know, one of the basic rules of strategy, aside from never get involved in a land war in Asia, is divide and conquer. So in the East, the church was divided. There were four bishops, all jockeying for power. It made it easier for the emperor to rise above all of them. And I'll explain what happens in the West differently. And then a final factor, I believe, is that the emperor spent most of his time in the capital, in Constantinople, in the East. The bishop of Constantinople, therefore, always had the boss metaphorically looking over his shoulder. Actually, literally, he always had them in the front row front pew of church. The emperor always knew what the bishop of Constantinople was up to. Henry Chadwick points out that the bishop of Constantinople therefore had a dual role. He was both the chief pastor of a large city, but he was also the court chaplain, with all its attendant necessity for placating the royal master. And in fact, if you read the history of St. John Chrysostom, you'll discover his fortunes are very tightly tied to how well he was, how good he was with the emperor, and particularly the empress. We'll come back to that. In fact, we'll talk to him right about now. An example of that is what some people call, Henry Chadwick in particular, calls this the tragedy of John Chrysostom. So John, and then we're talking the late 300s here, John was the bishop of Antioch. He was a gifted preacher. He was probably the most noted preacher in the East of his day. But in Constantinople, they were the capital city. Capital city always has to have the best. So they essentially kidnapped John and brought him to Constantinople and made him the bishop so that the capital could have the most celebrated preacher. But John didn't fit very well in the capital city. He was lived in an ascetic lifestyle. He was used to speaking, as we now say, truth to power, or at least what he thought to be truth. He soon made enemies. He offended the rich by saying that private property was a result of the fall. He alienated men by saying that they should be as faithful to their wives as they expected their wives to be faithful to them. He offended women by pillorying their extravagant cosmetics. And then he preached a sermon against Jezebel. You remember Jezebel? That was widely understood to be describing the empress. So basically, he alienated everybody he needed to have on his side. Well, there was a bishop named Theophilus in Alexandria, and I think I mentioned some weeks ago that Alexandria, which was a big city, had the great library, it was the home of great scholarship, it, at least they thought, had a great deal of antiquity as a Christian see. They were, the rulers of Alexandria were always envious of Constantinople, a jumped up little two-bit town that had suddenly become the capital of the world, but had no pedigree. And they were always upset that Constantinople had more power than they did. So Theophilus, who was a pretty sketchy character, traveled to Constantinople. He convened a kangaroo court, which deposed John on false charges. The emperor and empress could have intervened to protect John. As I mentioned, his relationship with the emperor and empress was an up-and-down thing. There are moments when they loved him, and there are moments when they hated him. And Theophilus picked a moment when John was in bad odor. John was not a man to help himself. So he's been deposed. He's about to be sent into exile. His only hope is the emperor and the empress Eudoxia. And this is how he begins his next sermon. Again Herodias rages. Again she dances. Again she seeks to have the head of John on a plate. The empress decided not to intervene to protect John. So he was sent into exile. They brought him back briefly, sent him back again, and he died in the year 407, very ill in harsh conditions. So John Chrysostom is an object lesson in what happens when the Eastern Church is subservient to the emperor and is viewed as a department of state, and when you offend the empire. So now we'll think about the West. The West, there was a greater sense that the church and state each had their own legitimate spheres of power and were not to intrude on each other. Here are a couple of factors that I think that contributed to that. One is that in the West, in contrast to these, there was only one important city, one city with apostolic pretensions, and that was Rome. Furthermore, Rome had also, in addition to the prestige of Peter and Paul, it had the prestige and mystique of having been the center of the world for hundreds of years. It was the center of the Roman Empire long before Christianity was ever thought of. This gave the Roman Church all sorts of authority, and it being Rome the big city in the West and the big locus of power vis-a-vis the state. Furthermore, the emperor, particularly after Constantine, rarely resided in the West. He became more and more an absentee figure. In fact, a lot of the government went with the emperor. If you want to be an ambitious civil servant, you want to rise in the chancery, you got to be close to the boss. And so the most ambitious people, the most able people, set up shop near the emperor in Constantinople. This all left a power vacuum in the West. The church stepped into it. So able men like Ambrose or Augustine became the chief men, not just of the church, but of society as a whole. Ambrose, of course, was the governor of the region around Milan, and he was called to be bishop when he was just a Christian layman, because he was such an outstanding figure in the secular administration, and they wanted him in the church. And so he dominated Milan, which was sort of the summer capital of the emperor for many years. Augustine, he was in a bit of a two-bit backwater. Hippo Regius was not a particularly major city, but I mentioned when I taught the class on Augustine some time ago that a great deal of Augustine's day was taken up in functioning as a judge. In North Africa, the bishops were routinely in charge, they became the men in charge, of running the law courts because the actual Roman officials weren't very good at it. They were corrupt, and the population, Christian or not, trusted Christian bishops to give fair judgments. And so again, you have a power vacuum. The church, in the person of its bishops, steps in and takes over. And so you have a church that is more self-confident, a church that is full of great men, a church that is facing a Roman power that is somewhat distant, and the local local representatives of Roman power aren't particularly gifted men. As I said, the church becomes more self-confident. The church begins to see herself as an equal to the state. The church sees herself as competent in her sphere and tells the Roman Empire to stay in his lane, as we now say. So I gave you an example of the tragedy of John Chrysostom in the East. So here's an example in the West, how this different Western view played out. And this is the story, the very famous story of Ambrose and Theodosius, Theodosius I, the Great. In 390, the population of Thessalonica rioted against the garrison of Gothic troops and killed the army commander. In a rage, the emperor ordered that 7,000 citizens of Thessalonica be herded into the stadium and executed, which they were. This came to Ambrose's attention, and he excommunicated Theodosius, explaining his actions thus: "Should I remain silent? But then the worst thing would happen, as my conscience would be bound and my words taken away. And where would they be then? When a priest does not talk to a sinner, then the sinner will die in his sin, and the priest will be guilty because he failed to correct him." Notice, Ambrose just talks to the emperor and calls him a sinner. He doesn't say to your holiness, he doesn't say to your magnificence, he doesn't say to your royal highness. He may be all those things in his sphere, but in the sphere of the church, in the eyes of a priest who is there to declare the word of the Lord, Theodosius is simply a sinner who needs to be rebuked, who needs to be called to repentance, who needs to be shown the way back into the fold. And Ambrose says, "I wouldn't be a priest. I would not be a Christian minister if I didn't treat you, no matter how magnificent your robes are, if I didn't treat you as a sinner, as any other sinner that comes before me." And so Ambrose is declaring the right of the church to speak to the highest of the state and say, "You must not approach the table of the Lord unless you repent." After 8 months of public penance, and after Theodosius agreed to a law that would require a 30-day cooling-off interval before death sentences could be carried out, Ambrose did readmit the emperor to the Eucharist. There's a famous painting of this that shows Ambrose sort of kneeling in the snow, Theodosius kneeling in the snow, and Ambrose saying, "No, you're not going to come in." We think that's artistic license. We don't know if Theodos has ever actually, you know, tried to come into the church. Ambrose made it very clear that he would not be welcome, he would not be allowed in. And everybody got the message in the West there. By the way, this is just a side note. I may talk about this a little bit in another lesson. I said after doing 8 public penance, that's all there was in these days. There was no such thing as the modern sacrament of private penance. Talk more about that another day. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things the church gained and things that church lost. There are some obvious things that the church gained, and there's some obvious things that society gained from the ascendancy of Christianity. I'm going to list a bunch of things. Some of these actually come from Constantine very early on. Some of them come from different emperors. I'm not going to bore you with who said what when. These all sort of cumulative results of Constantine's conversion and his followers. But, for instance, the laws were written forbidding the sitting of law courts and secular labor on Sunday. This actually came from Constantine in 321, rather, having just told you I wasn't going to give you dates, now I did. But Constantine was helping the government, you know, using the government to help Christians sanctify the Lord's Day, saying that we're not going to haul you into court for legal business on that day. He didn't tie it very closely to the Mosaic commandment. In fact, he called it the Day of the Sun, which is, of course, why we call it Sunday. But he did this because he knew that Sunday was, in fact, the Christian Sabbath. Women were granted the right to control their property and to be guardians of children, a right they had never had. Laws were passed preventing easy divorce, which in this context really meant that men were prevented from arbitrarily divorcing their wives. In the old Roman world, a man could divorce his wife as easily as, well, a Muslim can today by saying, I divorce you 3 times. This obviously, in a world like that, caused much greater hardship to a woman than it did to a man. Infanticide was made a crime. The state of New York has gone back on that, but for many years it was a crime, and it was because of Christianity, because of the emperor. Remember, this is a time when it was very common to expose unwanted children. The vast majority of whom were women. A father had absolute control over the lives and deaths of everyone in his household. If a father wanted to kill a child, he could do so, and the Roman law completely endorsed his power to do so. That was restricted by Constantine and his successors. There was a prohibition of branding criminals and torturing them before trial. Maybe torture was okay afterward, but at least they prohibited torture before the trial and the branding. I've mentioned Constantine outlawed gladiatorial combats, some of the most cruel and bloodthirsty sports in the Roman Empire, one of the greatest thrills for so many in the Roman Empire. So a number of very positive things. Then there are some things that are two-edged. So I'm going to list these under the negatives. Clergy were exempted from military and certain public duties. That had, of course, the advantage of allowing clergy to pursue their work as ministers. When I say certain public duties, we don't really have that, but in the Roman Empire, and actually long into British history, as just one example, you could be required, if you were a man of some standing, to serve in the local government. Imagine if there was a law that says if, you know, you're like a middle-class citizen, you have to become a member of the city council. And as a member of the city council, you have to provide lavish entertainments for the people. It was a real burden in English history. Again, this is sort of going a little far afield, but in English history, you hear sometimes of people being offered knighthoods and refusing them because of all the obligations that entailed to give money to the king, to entertain him when his retinue came through, and so on. So clergy were exempted from these things. Church property was exempted from taxes. Churches were allowed to receive legacies. This all could be a good thing. It allowed churches to have more money with which to carry out their charitable endeavors. But, of course, it also meant they had more money. And it meant that they could go get money. And there were ministers and bishops, priests and bishops, who were notorious for were traveling from bedside to bedside, figuring out who's going to die quickly and ingratiating themselves with soon-to-be dead people who were rich, trying to get in the will. And in fact, in places, the empire actually supported the church, which is, of course, the way it is in many, many countries even today. If the government pays you, you obviously have much less need to rely on the voluntary giving of your church members, and that also means you have much less incentive to have church members. In parts of Europe today, there are churches even in secular, very secular countries like Germany, that receive a large percent of their income from the government. Everyone is taxed to support the church unless you specifically opt out. And that has obviously some negative effects on the church. The church also was all too happy to have the state enforce religious compliance. As we've noticed, some bishops protested, pointing out that God wants people who worship in spirit and truth, and not just because there is a sword at their throat. But even Augustine, who would say these kinds of things, eventually found a way to justify imperial coercion in the case of the Donatists. Now, we must remember that the Donatists were also very often terrorists. They were pretty violent men themselves, and this is an example of how sometimes these things are not as clear-cut as you might like. Augustine would have said, if you'd caught him on the right day, no, you can't force someone to be a worshiper of the true God. But when he saw people in his congregation walking in with scars because Adonijah had thrown acid in their eyes, you can sort of see why he thought, maybe it's not such a bad idea to have the imperial police hunt these people down and shut down their churches. Anyway, that seed developed bitter fruit, as we know throughout the rest of church history. And then there was simply what the negative effects that come with being the majority. When you're the majority, you think things are going your way. You think they ought to go your way. When you're a majority, it's harder and harder to remember the situation of the minority. It's harder to have compassion for them. It's harder to be in their shoes. And I'm going to illustrate this with a famous case. As I will say, I don't think this is exactly flows just because Christianity became the state religion. But I think it does illustrate the dangers of being the majority culture. Of not having to tread lightly, not having to make sure you're walking uprightly. This is the case of Hypatia. She was a famous woman philosopher and mathematician in Alexandria in the late 300s and early 400s. She is today, for reasons that will become clear immediately, a feminist icon. There is a journal of feminist philosophy called Hypatia, and she is often used as an illustration of how Christians are evil, misogynist, anti-intellectual, and just generally very, very bad people. I don't think that's entirely fair, but there's still plenty to say bad about the Christians of that particular period. So as I said, she was a philosopher. She was a Neoplatonist philosopher, a pagan. She was a famous teacher. She attracted many students. She actually got along very well with Christians. She was friendly with a bishop. She was the teacher of another soon-to-be bishop. The ancient sources describe her as quite beautiful. And she was good at math. And who can resist that combination? Well, the bishop of Alexandria died. There was an ugly political struggle for control of the church. So right away, the church is lost. And it seems that Hypatia's followers were thought to be too friendly with one faction in the conflict. And eventually, a lector is a church, a lower-level clergyman who reads the scripture passages during the service. A lector in the church named Peter incited a mob, which assaulted and murdered her in a very brutal fashion in the year 415. So much has been made of this great outrage by later generations to serve whatever their current cause is. Her murder is often held up as an example of Christian bigotry against women, against learning, against learned women, and against pagans. Sometimes you'll even hear the claim that the mob uh, not satisfied with her blood, went on to burn down the famous Library of Alexandria, the greatest library of the ancient world. Never mind that we actually know the library had ceased to exist a century before her. In fact, it's fascinating. You read anything about the library, and there's a long list of suspects. I think the only person who hasn't been implicated in the destruction of the Library of Alexandria is Lee Harvey Oswald, and I wouldn't put it past him for that either. But as I said, the facts are damning enough. It may not have been an anti-woman, anti-philosophy, anti-pagan riot, but the fact is, a group of Christians were willing to join a mob, and they were willing to commit a foul murder at the leadership of a church official, and they were willing to do this as part of a church dispute over who got to rule their particular little church. That fact alone, those facts alone, are indication that the world, at least in this particular place and in this moment, conquered the church. And when you're in the majority, you're just more open to doing that kind of thing, more open to thinking that might makes right. No longer did that mob consider heeding the call to view others as better than themselves. No longer were they believing that true religion was caring for the weak and helpless. No longer were they walking before unbelievers in such a way as to ordain or adorn the gospel of the grace of God. So the conversion of Constantine, the Christianization of the empire, brought some great benefits. It's certainly a great benefit to think that your children are not going to be skewered by imperial soldiers. I've lived a very easy life, and it's easy for me not to think about how great it is, not have to worry that the government's going to break into my house and kill me. I don't want to downplay that at all. There are great benefits of a government that adopts Christian morality in many ways. But there are great temptations. With success comes temptation, and that certainly has been true of the church. You heard the story, the saying, be careful what you pray for. God may answer your prayer. As I say, I'm not sure that anybody actually in the Christian church prayed for the conversion of the emperor. That was something that I think they couldn't even imagine having happened. And once it happened, they were ecstatic, as Eusebius was. But there are certainly dangers to that, too. It's easy to win and take your eyes off of Christ. And you know, the moral story is you keep your eyes on Christ, whether you're the persecuted minority or the great dominant majority. And that's a lesson you can take no matter what the fortunes of the church or your personal fortunes turn out to be. All right, so that's it for today. I intend to do two more lessons. I want to do a lesson on the sacraments and then a wrap-up lesson. There's a Genesis 39 in the way here in between. So basically, I'm planning two more lessons. I think I'm going to finish on April 7th, and then Pastor Rayburn has something for you afterwards, which I won't tell you what it is yet. So thanks for coming.